back to Hyphenated America, where we make immigration laws and policies easier to understand. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Maria. This week, we'll be discussing asylum, what it is, who applies for it, and assaults on the program, among other things.
Later on in this episode, we are so excited to speak to immigration attorney Ava Benach. Ava is a founding member of Benach Colopy. Nearly 20 years, she has navigated clients through the maze of immigration law.
So we're going to start off by discussing how someone would qualify for asylum. An individual is able to apply for asylum if they have suffered persecution or fear of persecution due to race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. Two ways to apply for asylum, which are through affirmative and defensive asylum processes. The main distinction here is that a defensive asylum application is for a person facing removal proceedings, meaning they are already before an immigration judge.
So in order to apply for asylum, a person must fear returning to their home country. Due to the large number of asylum seekers taken into custody when entering the U.S., a question that comes up a lot is, what is the timing for the processing of an asylum case? For people that are placed into removal proceedings, how long do they have to wait until their court date? Under the Immigration and Nationality Act, the USCIS has 45 days after the date at which the asylum application is filed to conduct an interview with the applicant. After their interview, they have 180 days to make a decision. At this point, an asylum officer either approves your asylum application or refers you to immigration court. If you're referred to a master calendar hearing at immigration court, it could take longer than a year for your case to be heard. Of course, these wait times only get longer as the country faces COVID-19. But there's something that everyone should understand about the 45 days. You know, for a long time, the USCIS was interviewing within that time frame, then they fell behind, and people waited over a year for an interview. In 2018, the government changed the policy of scheduling the oldest cases first because they thought people were gaming the system. It's now a last-in, first-out system.
So basically, if you filed last month, you're going to have an interview before someone who might have filed 5 years ago.
Right, and that leaves very little time for the new people to prepare for their cases.
In terms of average rates at which asylum cases are heard before the immigration court, according to 2018 data from DHS, out of over 260,000 cases of asylum filed, only 25,000 were granted, which puts the acceptance rate at 9.6%, which is very low. There are a lot of things that can affect asylum cases, including purely subjective factors, such as the judge and who the trial attorney is for the case. There are currently 12 immigration courts that have denial rates higher than 90%. Which includes several judges that are known for having a denial rate between 99 to 100%.
One of our listeners has asked, do we see any significant differences in denial rate by nationality? And, you know, the answer is yes. The Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services has found the following denial rates by nationality using data from 2012 to 2017. You know, we have Mexico at 88%, Haiti at 86%, El Salvador at 79%, and so on.
There have been recent attacks on the asylum program from the Trump administration. During a visit to the U.S.-Mexico border in April 2019, President Trump said during his briefing, "We can't take you anymore. Our country is full." This type of thinking encapsulates his administration's logic behind many of the policies aimed at dissuading asylum seekers from coming to the U.S. These policies include the zero tolerance policy, which resulted in family separation, the Remain in Mexico policy, which is still active today, and the recent asylum ban, which was just struck down in federal court in July.
So let's talk about Central Americans fleeing violence and tragic conditions in their home countries. You know, Amnesty International has found that the three main reasons that unaccompanied minors flee Northern Triangle countries, they're fleeing violence in their community and home, actively avoiding recruitment into gangs, and avoiding exploitation in the form of prostitution or human trafficking. You know, it's very sad that general home country conditions are not enough to grant an asylum case. An applicant has to prove personal persecution in order to be awarded asylum.
Exactly. To put this into perspective, the country conditions are so horrific that these people are willing to travel thousands of miles through Mexico to reach the United States. These journeys are incredibly dangerous, and frequently, asylum seekers face violence by Mexican officials and cartel members during their travels. There have been hundreds of disappearances of migrants in Mexico reported in recent years. So I think it's important to underscore the deadly costs and tough conditions that migrants face from all countries to even get to the United States.
So what is the current state of our asylum program? The International Rescue Committee just published a piece titled "How the Trump Administration is Using COVID-19 to End Asylum," which discusses the various ways asylum seekers are being put in even more vulnerable situations by the current administration.
Immigration officials are holding asylum seekers in detention centers all over the border that lack the adequate care to combat COVID-19. Also, the expectations of evidence for asylum cases has increased to include police reports and other documentation of persecution, which is hard to obtain. And you are automatically removed from the country and denied the chance to apply for asylum if you're suspected to have been in contact with someone that has COVID-19, which will lead to the removal of many healthcare workers.
As we mentioned at the beginning of this episode, we are so excited to have immigration attorney Ava Benach with us today. Ava has represented clients in immigration courts across the country, addressing cutting-edge issues in asylum, the immigration consequences of criminal convictions and jurisdiction, and due process. In addition, Ava is active in local immigration charities and organizations. She has taken a lead role in representing transgender asylum seekers before the asylum office and the immigration courts. Welcome, Ava, to the podcast. We are so excited to have you.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. So this week's episode focuses on asylum, a topic that has been targeted by the Trump administration. Fortunately, federal judge Kelly ruled that the Trump administration had to end a policy that effectively barred most Central American migrants fleeing poverty and persecution from obtaining asylum. So what do you view as the future of the asylum program in light of this recent rule and past actions of this administration?
Judge Kelly's decision is a lot like the Supreme Court on DACA. It's about process. And the Immigration Nationality Act gives the president and the administration a lot of authority to affect asylum in a variety of ways. So although that was a huge victory and protects a lot of people, the administration can sort of go back to the drawing board and do it right. The best thing we could say about this administration is that they're not very good at the law.
Right.
You see that with DACA. You see that with this, the safe third country thing that Judge Kelly just knocked down. It's not whether the president and the administration can do it. It's a question of how they did it. So they can go back to the drawing board and redo the whole thing and put it in place in a way that is likely to pass a fairly deferential level of judicial review.
So, you know, more broadly, you know, why do you think that President Trump has targeted legal asylum seekers? You know, you said this administration doesn't necessarily seem to be great at the law. So why do you think this particular program has been targeted?
Well, they don't like them.
Right.
I mean, they don't like asylum seekers. They don't like seeing men in front of 7-Elevens. They don't like houses that have multiple cars in front of them. They do not think that they are legitimately fleeing persecution as they understand that term. Their view of persecution is rooted in the Holocaust, where you had a powerful state actor that was actively targeting people of a religion, people of ethnicities, political opinions. It's very much formed in a Cold War sort of, the government is the only legitimate persecutor of people for the purposes of asylum. And what you have in Central America, and that's who they're targeting, they're not targeting Iranian Christians.
Right.
So would you say that this is like mostly culturally charged and it's more about the identity of the people seeking asylum?
It is. It is a effort to clamp down on a particular class of asylum seeker, those that show up at the border. And while I've made two trips to the border, so I know that the entire world is on our southern border. There's Africans, there's Asians, but 99% of them are Central Americans. And so by putting in place a number of restrictions that only really apply to the southern border, and by making a number of very specific proposals to amend the immigration regulations, they're clearly targeting Central American migration. What I mean by that is that they're looking at who the persecutor is. They're looking at motivations, and they're trying to say that if you are subject to violence because of just criminal activity, which is what they call gangs, then you have no claim to asylum. But that doesn't really reflect current reality in these countries. Current reality is that the gangs are quasi-states, act in ways that states do. They tax people. They monitor comings and goings. In certain places, they have some level of social services, not out of the goodness of their heart, but to create new gang members. Nonetheless, they are acting more and more like the government, and very often they act in concert with the government. Police officers, government officials have all been implicated in working with the gangs in Central America. They're trying to sort of undo a decade worth of immigration law that's recognized this changing reality that it's no longer just an all-powerful central government, whether it be Nazi Germany or the Iranian regime or the Chinese Communist Party, that it's really these non-governmental actors who have a lot of control. And there's nothing new about that. We've always recognized that groups that the government is unable or unwilling to control can persecute people for the purposes of asylum. Nobody argues about whether the Taliban, who are not in power in Afghanistan, can't be a legitimate persecutor. Nobody argued that ISIS couldn't be a legitimate persecutor. And for decades past, you had the FARC and the ELN, and Shining Path of Peru, and the FARC and ELN in Colombia. So there's been a long history of protecting people from non-governmental persecutors.
That narrative of just like the gangs in Central America definitely fits into the Trump administration's, you know, kind of like definition of these types of people. So it definitely suits them to be like, it's not our fault that there's so many thugs down there.
But it is. Mm-hmm. And we deported those people and they took it with them.
Agreed. So kind of switching gears here, we understand that there are changes to work authorization eligibility for asylum seekers that will be effective in late August. This is already a very vulnerable position. Can you explain how these rules will affect those seeking asylum? Is anyone challenging them? And do you think there'll be litigation against this?
Well, there's certainly going to be litigation. I can't say that I know that it's happened already. But the basic change is that under the law as it exists now, you have to wait for 180 days after you file an application for asylum to be able to obtain a work authorization. My experience working with hundreds of asylum seekers over the last several years is that that period of time is usually a very challenging period of time for people. They don't have the ability to work. They are here, and that's not easy. What they want to do is change the period of time you have to wait for a work permit. So instead of being able to apply after 150 days, you now have to wait 365 days. And that's a long time not to be able to work, not to be able to have ID, not be able to get a driver's license or go about your life. And it would be, you know, the whole idea when they created these timelines for work authorization was that the case would be adjudicated in time. And it was only in these rare instances when the adjudications lasted longer that they would give them a work authorization. But now you have adjudication backlogs that are 4, 5, 6 years. It's almost guaranteed that people are going to have to apply for work authorization. And the longer you make them work, the greater hardship people have.
I was going to say, it's like they're completely hamstrung. So it seems like they just want to dissuade them from getting any type of independence.
Well, they want to discourage applying for asylum. They believe that applying for asylum and getting a work permit 6 months later is an incentive to file fake claims. They believe that, and this is obviously designed to undermine that. But what I have learned and what I've seen over doing this for now 2 decades, I know I don't look that young, that old, is that you can't out-cruel the gangs. You can't out-cruel the Taliban or the Iranian mullahs or the Chinese Communist Party. People are always going to seek protection of the United States because there's a myth, there's a belief. And that's what drives people to the United States, is they believe that they can be protected and safe in America. And as much as Stephen Miller and his crew try to undo that by upping the level of cruelty, they're never going to be successful.
Absolutely. So we just wanted to finish off by talking a little bit about your background. You know, so we noted that you've provided pro bono representation for transgender asylum seekers. You know, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into such pro bono work and the challenges associated with it?
How to get into the work? Well, it's a vulnerable population and who often need quality legal representation. I'm trans myself, So it seemed like an obvious way I could help the community. And it's been a very rewarding thing for me. We have won almost uniformly, and we are able to see people who have come here with little to nothing and horrific histories of violence in their home countries, you know, really flourish and start businesses and have families. And that's a beautiful thing to witness. The challenges are that the Central American trans community is subjected to such a level of violence, hatred, enmity. They're rejected by family, by church, by school. The police don't protect them. The police often are one of their principal sources of persecution. The gangs, nobody is kind to them. Nobody is loving to them. You might imagine there are trust issues. It takes some time to build a rapport. And sometimes it's very hard for a white attorney from Washington, D.C. to really be able to connect with someone who had 2 or 3 years of formal schooling and has been, are we allowed to curse on this podcast?
Oh, absolutely.
Who's been shit on her whole life by the community. People are damaged and people are hurt. And being able to provide them just a little bit of stability, you really see the resilience that people have and are able to build a life that's stable and satisfying and with love and work and all the things that make life worth living.
Well, thank you so much, Ava, for coming on the podcast. We so appreciate it.
Special thanks to Ava Benach for speaking with us. Be sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and our Facebook page, Hyphenated America, to stay up to date with the podcast. Also, be sure to check out our website, hyphenatedamerica.org, where you can access our guides, weekly breakdown of immigration news, and so much more.